April 15th marked the passing day of Jean Genet. It seemed to be the right moment to deliver the stones from Saint-Laurent prison to his grave in La Roche, only 60 miles from the conference. Paul Bowles once said that Tangier is a place where the past and present exist simultaneously in proportionate degree. There is something hidden in the fabric of this city, a weave that produces a sense of welcoming coupled with mistrust. I saw a bit of Tangier myself, first through his work, then through his eyes. I was first introduced to Bowles in a serendipitous way. In the summer of 1967, shortly after I left home and went to New York City, I passed a large box of overturned books spilling out into the street. Several were scattered across the sidewalk, and a dated copy of Who's Who in America lay open before my feet. I bent down to look as a photograph caught my eye above an entry for Paul Frederick Bowles. I had never heard of him, but I noticed we shared the same birthday, the 30th of December. Believing it to be a sign, I tore out the page and later searched out his books, the first being A Sheltering Sky. I read everything he wrote, as well as his translations, introducing me to the work of Mohammed Murabit and Isabel Eberhardt. 3 decades later, in 1997, I was asked by German Vogue to interview him in Tangier. I had mixed feelings about my assignment, for they mentioned he was ill, but I was assured he had readily agreed and that I would not be disturbing him. Bowles lived in a 3-room apartment on a quiet street in a straightforward 50s modern building in a residential section. A high stack of well-traveled trunks and suitcases formed a column in the entranceway. There were books lining the walls and halls, books that I knew and books I wished to know. He sat propped up in bed, wearing a soft plaid robe, and appeared to brighten when I entered the room. I crouched down trying to find a graceful position in the awkward air. We spoke of his late wife Jane, whose spirit seemed to be everywhere. I sat there twisting my braids, speaking about love. I wondered if he was really listening. "Are you writing?" I asked. "No, I am no longer writing." "How do you feel now?" I asked. "Empty," he answered. I left him to his thoughts and went upstairs to the patio on the roof. There were no camels in the courtyard, no burlap sacks spilling over with kief, no sebzi cocked on the edge of a jar. There was a cement roof overlooking other roofs, and lengths of muslin hung on lines that crisscrossed the space, opening onto the blue Tangier sky. I pressed my face against one of the damp sheets for a moment's respite from the stifling heat, yet immediately regretted doing so, for the impression marred its smooth perfection. I returned to him. His robe lay at his feet, well-worn leather slippers by the side of his bed. A young Moroccan named Karim kindly served us tea. He lived across the hall and often came over to check on how Paul was faring. Paul spoke of an island he owned that he no longer visited, music he no longer played, certain songbirds that were now extinct. I could see he was tiring. "We share the same birthday," I told him. He smiled wanly, his haloed eyes closing. We were approaching the end of our visit. Everything pours forth, photographs their history, books their words, walls their sounds. The spirits rose like an ether that spun an arabesque and touched down as gently as a benevolent mask. "Paul, I have to go. I will come back to see you." He opened his eyes and laid his long, lined hand upon mine. Now he is gone. I raised the top of my desk and located the oversized jetan matchbox still wrapped in Fred's handkerchief. I hadn't opened it for over 2 decades. The stones were safely there, with bits of prison earth clinging to them. The sight of them opened the wound of recognition. It was time to deliver them, though not in the way I had thought. I had already written Karam that I would be coming. When we had first met at Paul's apartment, I told him the story of the stones, and he promised that when the time came, that he would take me to La Roche Christian Cemetery, where Janae was buried. Karam swiftly answered, as if no time had passed. I am in the desert, but I will find you, and we will find Janae. I knew he would keep his word. I cleaned my camera and wrapped a few packs of film in a bandana and placed them between my shirts and dungarees. I was traveling even later than usual. I said goodbye to the cats, slipped the matchbox into my pocket, and left. My fellow compatriots Lenny Kaye and Tony Shanahan met me at the airport with their acoustic guitars, our first time together in Morocco. In the morning we were picked up in Casablanca, but the conference van broke down halfway to Tangier. We sat on the side of the road sharing stories about William and Alan, Peter and Paul, our beat apostles. Soon we boarded a lively bus, with the radios blaring in French and Arabic, passing a disabled bicycle, a stumbling burro, and a child brushing small stones from an injured knee. One of the passengers, a woman weighted down by several shopping bags, was harassing the driver. He finally stopped the bus, and some of the people got out and bought bottles of Coca-Cola at a convenience store. I happened to look out and saw the word kiosk written in Kufic style above the door. We checked into the Hotel Rembrandt, a longtime haven for writers from Tennessee Williams to Jane Bowles. We were given black notebooks with the words La Caloca Tangier stamped in green and our credentials, William Burroughs' face superimposed over the face of Brian Geisen, a third mind laminate. It was a lobby of reunion. Poets Anne Waldman and John Giorno, Pakir Attar, leader of the master musicians of Jijuka, musicians Lenny Kaye and Tony Shanahan. Alain Lahana of La Rat de Ville flew in from Paris. The filmmaker Frieder Schlock from Berlin and Karam drove in from the desert. For a moment we stood and looked at one another, the gone beats orphan children. We congregated in the early evenings for readings and panel discussions. As we read passages from the works of the writers we were saluting, a procession of overcoats worn by our great teachers entered and exited my sight line. Through the night, musicians improvised and dervishes whirled. Lenny and I fell into the familiar rhythms of our unconditional friendship. We had known each other for over 40 years, shared the same books, the same stages, the same birth month, the same year. We had long dreamed of working in Tangier and wandered aimlessly through the Medina in contented silence. The snaking alleys were infused with a golden light that we religiously followed until we realized we were walking in circles. After we performed our duties, we spent the night at the Palais Moulay Hafid, listening to the master musicians of Jijuka, followed by Darganawa. Their high-spirited music drew me to dance. I danced surrounded by boys younger than my son. We moved in a similar style, but they displayed an inventiveness and flexibility that left me in awe. On my morning walk, I saw some of the boys smoking cigarettes in front of an abandoned movie theater. "You're up early," I said. They laughed. "We have not been to sleep yet." On the last evening, a small yet imposing figure dressed in a white jalaba, stitched with gold thread, entered our common area. It was Mohammed Murabit, and we all rose. He had passed the Sebzi with our beloved friends, and their tangible vibrations could be felt in the folds of his robe. As a youth, he had sat at a table telling stories to Paul Bowles, who translated them for Black Sparrow Press. They formed a string of wonderful tales, such as The Beach Cafe, that I had read and reread sitting in the Café Dante while dreaming of having a café of my own. "Do you want to go to the Beach Cafe tomorrow?" asked Karam. It never occurred to me that the cafe actually existed.
Is it a real cafe? I asked, taken aback.
Yes, he laughed. In the morning, I met Lenny at the Grand Café de Paris on the Boulevard Pasteur. I had seen pictures of Janae having tea with the writer Mohamed Choukri there. Though it resembled an early 60s cafeteria, there was no fare offered, only tea and Nescafé. Carved wood-paneled walls, brown leather-tufted benches, wine-colored tablecloths, heavy glass ashtrays. We sat in comfortable silence in a curved corner with wide windows so we could watch the comings and goings on the street outside. My Nescafé was delivered in a soft tube with a glass of hot water. Lenny ordered tea. Several men had gathered to smoke cigars beneath a fading portrait of the king with a fishing pole and his impressive catch. On the green marbled wall was a clock in the shape of a large pewter sun, delivering time in a timeless realm. Lenny and I drove along the coast to the beach cafe with Karim. It appeared closed and the beach deserted, an outpost on the other side of the cowpoke's mirror. Karim went into the cafe and found a man who reluctantly made us mint tea. He brought it outside on a table and went back inside. Down by the shore, hidden by a cliff, were the rooms described by Marabit. I removed my shoes, rolled up my pants, and waded in the sea in a place I had come to know through the pages of his book. I dried off in the sun and drank some of the tea, which was very sweet. There were many places to sit, but I was attracted to an ornate white plastic chair set against a bramble bush. I took two shots and then gave my camera to Lenny, and he photographed me sitting in it. Back at the table, not more than a few feet away, I quickly unpeeled the Polaroids. I was dissatisfied with my framing of the chair and turned to take another, but it was gone. Lenny and I were astonished. No one was around, yet the chair had vanished within moments.
"This is crazy," said Lenny.
"This is Tangier," said Karim. Karim went inside the cafe and I followed. The cafe was empty. I left my shot of the white chair in the center of the table. "This is also Tangier," I said. We drove along the coast to the sound of waves and the overriding song of crickets, then over a swirl of dusty roads and past whitewashed villages and bits of desert dotted with yellow flowers. Karim parked on the side of the road and we followed him to the house of Marabit. We made our way down the hill as an unruly herd of goats was coming up. Much to our delight, they parted, then surrounded us. The master was not in, but his goats entertained us. As we headed back to Tangier, we saw a shepherd guiding a camel with her calf. Rolling down the window, I called out, "What is the little one's name?" "His name is Jimi Hendrix. Hooray, I wake from yesterday." "Inshallah," he called out. I rose early, slipped the matchbox into my pocket, and went for a last coffee at Café de Paris. Feeling strangely detached, I wondered if I was about to engage in a meaningless ritual. Janae had passed away in the spring of 1986, before I was able to complete my mission, and the stones had remained in my desk for more than two decades. I ordered another Nescafé, remembering. I was sitting at the small table in the kitchen beneath the picture of Camus when I heard the news. Fred placed his hand on my shoulder, then left me to my thoughts. I felt a sense of regret, of suspended gesture, but could do nothing but offer the words I would write. In early April, Janae had traveled with his companion Jackie Maglia from Morocco to Paris to correct the publisher's proofs of what would be his final book. He was turned away from his customary Paris residence, the Hotel Rubens, because a night clerk failed to recognize him and was offended by his tramp-like appearance. They walked in the pouring rain seeking shelter, ending at the Hotel Jack, a then dicey one-star, near the Place d'Italie. In a room no more than a cell, Janae labored over his pages. Although afflicted with terminal throat cancer, he avoided painkillers, determined to remain unclouded. Having taken barbiturates throughout his life, he abstained just when he needed them most, for the desire to perfect his manuscript overrode all physical suffering. On April 15th, Jean Genet died alone on the floor of the bathroom of his tiny room in the transient hotel. Most likely he had tripped on the small step leading to the cubicle. On the night table was his legacy, his last work intact. On that same day, the United States bombed Libya. There were rumors that Hanna Gaddafi, the adopted child of Colonel Gaddafi, was killed in the raid. As I sat and wrote, I imagined the orphaned innocent leading the orphan thief into paradise. My Nescafe had gone cold. I motioned for another. Lenny arrived and ordered tea. The morning was slow-moving. We sat back and surveyed the room, conscious that the writers we so admired had spent many hours conversing in it together. "They are all still here," we agreed, and walked back to the hotel. Karim was called back to the desert, but Frieder arranged for a driver to take us all to Larache. Five of us assembled, Lenny, Tony, Frieder, Alan, and I, all reaching for the hand of Janae. Surrounded by friends, I hadn't anticipated the deep loneliness I was to feel, nor the resentful heartache I used all my strength to dispel. Janae was dead and belonged to no one. My knowledge of Fred, who had taken me all the way to San Laurent de Moroni for a few small stones, belonged to me. I sought but could not feel his presence, and sank back into the vestiges of memory until I found him, dressed in khaki, his long hair shorn, standing alone in the undergrowth of tall grass and spreading palms. I saw his hand and wristwatch. I saw his wedding ring and his brown leather shoes. As we approached the city of Larache, the sense of sea was strong. It was an old fishing port, not far from ancient Phoenician ruins. We parked near a fortress and made our way up a hill to the cemetery. An old woman and a small boy were there as if in wait and opened the gate for us. The cemetery had a Spanish feel, and Janae's grave was facing east, overlooking the sea. I cleared the debris from his gravesite, removing dead flowers, twigs, and bits of broken glass, and then washed the headstone with bottled water. The child watched me intently. I said the words I wished to say, then poured water upon the ground and dug deep, inserting the stones. As we laid our flowers, we could hear the distant sound of the muezzin calling the people to prayer. The boy quietly sat where I buried the stones and pulled the petals off the flowers, sprinkling them on his trousers, staring at us with his big black eyes. Before we left, he handed me the remnants of a silk rosebud, faded pink, which I placed in the matchbox. We gave the old woman some money, and she closed the gate. The boy seemed sad to see his strange playmates depart. The return was a sleepy one. Every so often, I would look at my pictures. Eventually, I would place the Polaroids of Janae's grave in a box with the graves of others. But in my heart, I knew the miracle of the rose was not the stones, nor could be found in the photographs, but was within the cells of the child guardian, Janae's prisoner of love. Covered ground. Memorial Day was fast approaching. I had a longing to see my little house, my Alamo, train or no train. The great storm destroyed the Broad Channel Rail Bridge, washing out more than 1,500 feet of track, completely flooding two stations on the A-line, requiring massive repairs, signals, switches, and wiring. There was no point in being impatient. It remained a truly daunting task, like piecing together the shattered mandolin of Bill Monroe. I called my friend Winch, the overseer of its slow renovation, to hitch a ride to Rockaway Beach. It was sunny, though unseasonably cold, so I wore an old pea coat and my watch cap. Having time to kill, I got a large deli coffee and waited for him on my stoop. The sky was clear save for a few drifting clouds, and I followed them back to northern Michigan on another Memorial Day in Traverse City. Fred was flying, and our young son Jackson and I were walking along Lake Michigan. The beach was littered with hundreds of feathers. I laid down an Indian blanket and got out my pen and notebook. "I am going to write," I told him. "What will you do?" He surveyed the area with his eyes fixing on the sky. "I'm going to think," he said. "Well, thinking is a lot like writing." "Yes," he said, "only in your head." He was approaching his fourth birthday, and I marveled at his observation. I wrote, Jackson reflected, and Fred flew, somehow all connected through the blood of concentration. We had a happy day, and when the sun began to recede, I gathered up our things, along with a few feathers, and Jack ran on ahead, anticipating his father's return. Even now, his father dead for some 20 years, and Jackson a man, anticipating the arrival of his own son, I can picture that afternoon, the strong waves of Lake Michigan lapping the shore littered with the feathers of molting gulls, Jackson's little blue shoes, his quiet ways, the steam rising from my thermos of black coffee, and the gathering clouds that Fred would be eyeing from the cockpit window of a Piper Cherokee. "Do you think he can see us?" Jack asked. "He always sees us, my boy," I answered. Images have their way of dissolving and then abruptly returning, pulling along the joy and pain attached to them, like tin cans rattling from the back of an old-fashioned wedding vehicle. A black dog on a strip of beach, Fred standing in the shadows of mangy palms flanking the entrance to Saint Laurent prison, the blue and yellow jetan matchbox wrapped in his handkerchief, and Jackson racing ahead, searching for his father in the pale sky. I slid into the pickup truck with Winch. We didn't talk much, both of us lost in our own thoughts. There was little traffic, and we made it in about 40 minutes. We met with the four fellows who made up his crew, hard-working men sensitive to their task. I noticed all my neighbors' trees were dead. They were the closest I had to trees of my own. The great storm surges that flooded the streets had killed most of the vegetation. I inspected all that there was to see. The mildewed pasteboard walls forming small rooms had been gutted, opening onto a large room with the century-old vaulted ceiling intact, and rotted floors were being removed. I could feel progress and left with a bit of optimism. I sat on the makeshift step of what would be my refurbished porch and envisioned a yard with wildflowers. Anxious for some permanency, I guess I needed to be reminded how temporal permanency is. I walked across the road toward the sea. A newly stationed shore patrol shooed me away from the beach area. They were dredging where the boardwalk had been. The sand-colored outpost that had briefly housed Zach's cafe was under government renovation, repainted canary yellow and bright turquoise, expunging its foreign legion appeal. I could only hope the dramatically cheery colors would bleach out in the sun. I walked further down to gain entrance on the beach, got my feet wet, and then got some coffee to go from the sole surviving taco stand. I asked if anyone had seen Zach. "He made the coffee," they told me. "Is he here?" I asked. "He's somewhere around." Clouds drifted overhead. Memorial clouds. Passenger jets were taking off from JFK. Winch finished his tasks, and we got back into the pickup truck and headed back across the channel, past the airport, over the bridge, and into the city. My dungarees were still damp from skirting the sea, and bits of sand shook out onto the floor that had been caught in the rolled-up folds. When I finished the coffee, I couldn't part with the empty container. It occurred to me I could preserve the history of Eno, the lost boardwalk, and whatever came to mind in microscript upon the styrofoam cup, like an engraver etching the 23rd Psalm on the head of a pin. When Fred died, we held his memorial in the Detroit Mariners church where we were married. Every November, Father Ingalls, who wed us, held a service in memory of the 29 crew members who went down in Lake Superior on the Edmund Fitzgerald, ending with ringing the heavy Brotherhood bell 29 times. Fred was deeply moved by this ritual, and as his memorial coincided with theirs, the father allowed the flowers and the model of the ship to be left on the stage. Father Ingalls presided over the service and wore an anchor around his neck in lieu of a cross. The evening of the service, my brother Todd came upstairs for me, but I was still in bed. "I can't do it," I told him. "You have to," he said adamantly, and he shook me from my torpor, helped me to dress, and drove me to the church. I thought about what I would say, and the song "What a Wonderful World" came on the radio. Whenever we heard it, Fred would say, "Tricia, it's your song." "Why does it have to be my song?" I'd protest. "I don't even like Louis Armstrong." But he would insist the song was mine. It felt like a sign from Fred. So I decided to sing "What a Wonderful World" a cappella at the service. As I sang, I felt the simplistic beauty of the song, but I still didn't understand why he connected it with me, a question I had waited too long to ask. "Now it's your song," I said, addressing a lingering void. The world seemed drained of wonder. I did not write poems in a fever. I did not see the spirit of Fred before me, or feel the spinning trajectory of his journey. My brother stayed with me through the days that followed. He promised the children he would be there for them always and would return after the holidays. But exactly a month later, he had a massive stroke while wrapping Christmas presents for his daughter. The sudden death of Todd, so soon after Fred's passing, seemed unbearable. The shock left me numb. I spent hours sitting in Fred's favorite chair, dreading my own imagination. I rose and performed small tasks with the mute concentration of one imprisoned in ice. Eventually, I left Michigan and returned to New York with our children. One afternoon, while crossing the street, I noticed I was crying, but I could not identify the source of my tears. I felt a heat containing the colors of autumn. The dark stone in my heart pulsed quietly, igniting like a coal in a hearth. Who is in my heart, I wondered. I soon recognized Todd's humorous spirit, and as I continued my walk, I slowly reclaimed an aspect of him that was also myself, a natural optimism. And slowly the leaves of my life turned, and I saw myself pointing out simple things to Fred, skies of blue, clouds of white, hoping to penetrate the veil of a congenital sorrow. I saw his pale eyes looking intently into mine, trying to trap my walleye in his unfaltering gaze. That alone took up several pages that filled me with such painful longing that I fed them into the fire in my heart, like Gogol burning page by page the manuscript of Dead Souls too. I burned them all, one by one. They did not form ash, did not go cold, but radiated the warmth of human compassion. How Lyndon Kills the Things She Loves. Lyndon is running light-footed swift. She stops, drawn to a perfectly formed tree in the center of a meadow. She is impermeable save her Achilles heel, Detective James Skinner, head of her unit, and a suppressed desire for his love. They once partnered in the field and clandestinely in bed, but that is seemingly behind them. Still, a pale shadow moves across her face when she is in his presence. As she approaches her front door, she is surprised to find him waiting for her once more. Distances dissolve. Skinner comes to her human. Lyndon moves closer. In the hands of Skinner, she is home. A coin spins on its edge. How it falls is of little consequence. Heads you lose, tails you lose. Lyndon ignores the signs, believing she's in luck, striking a perfect balance of love and work, Skinner and her badge. The morning light illumines her rose-gold hair, pulled back with a rubber band. Silhouettes of victims in an unfolded paper doll stream momentarily dispel in the flame they have reignited. The sun shifts. One more body burning, evidence uncovered, a ring tightening around her throat. Surrendering to love, Skinner and Lyndon are mutually exposed. In his eyes, she suddenly sees other eyes, the horror of lurid depths. Forensic traces, soiled slips, hair ribbons soaked in shame. The rain falls from the blue-eyed skies of Sarah Lyndon. She is washed with murderous clarity. Using all her God-given skills, she identifies Skinner, her mentor, and her lover as the serial killer. Holder, her true confidant, pieces things together a beat behind her. With instinctive grace, Holder traces her movements. Racing through the oppressive rain, he tracks them to Skinner's concealed lake house. The promise of a lover's tryst now becomes the setting of an inexorable justice. Lyndon feels the vestiges of her joy floating among the dead. She will compassionately execute Skinner, ignoring Holder's pleas. He is cautious, protective. She is reckless. He watches in horror as Lyndon pulls the trigger, putting Skinner out of his misery, like a dying calf on the side of a road. Stunned, I can only bow my head. I meld with the racing mind of Holder, desperately trying to interpret her actions, foresee her future. My empty thermos remains by the bed, wrapped in the ominous atmosphere of episode number 38. It is not long before I am confronted with the cruelest of all spoilers. There will be no episode 39. The killing season is over. Lyndon has lost everything, and now I am losing her. A television network has snuffed the killing. There is the promise of a new show, yet another detective. But I am not ready to let her go. And I do not want to move on. I want to watch as Lyndon plumbs the depths of the lake, searching for feminine bones. What do we do with those who can be accessed and dismissed by a channel changer? That we love no less than a 19th-century poet, or an admired stranger, or a character from the pen of Emily Bronte. What do we do when one of them commingles with our own sense of self, only to be transferred into a finite space within an on-demand portal? All is in limbo. An anguished moan rises from the black water. Swathed in pink industrial plastic, the dead await their champion, Lyndon of the Lake. But she has been relegated to no more than a statue in the rain with a gun. Having done the unpardonable, she will virtually lay her badge on the table. A television series has its own moral reality. Pacing, I envision a spin-off, Lyndon in the Valley of the Lost. On the screen, the black water surrounds the lake house. The lake takes on the shape of a diseased kidney. Lyndon stares into the abyss where their sad remains lie. It's the loneliest thing in the world waiting to be found, she says. Holder, numb with grief and insomnia, waits in that same car, drinking the same cold coffee, sitting vigil until she signals and he is again by her side as they tramp purgatory together. Week by week, a victim's story unfolds. Holder will connect the spatter of blood dots. She will root out the healing spring. The linden tree will spread the scent of lime, purifying each girl, shedding her plastic shroud in the linen strips of hell. But who will purify Lyndon? What dark maid will cleanse the chambers of her adulterated heart? Lyndon is running. She abruptly stops and faces the camera, a Flemish Madonna with the eyes of a woman from the backwoods who has slept with the devil. Divested of everything, it's of little consequence to her. She did it for love. There is only one directive, that the lost are found, that the thick leaves encasing the dead are parted, and they are lifted into the arms of light. Valley of the Lost. Fred had a cowboy, the only cowboy among his cavalry. He was molded from red plastic, slightly bow-legged, and poised to shoot. Fred called him Reddy. At night, Reddy was not returned into a cardboard box with the rest of the components of Fred's small fortress, but set on a low bookcase next to his bed where he could see him. One day, as his mother was cleaning his room, she dusted the bookcase, and Reddy fell unnoticed and just disappeared. Fred searched for him for weeks, but he was nowhere to be found. He silently called to Reddy as he lay in bed. When he set up his fort and arranged his men on the floor of his room, he felt Reddy near, calling to him. It was not his own voice, but Reddy who called. Fred believed that, and Reddy became part of our common treasure, occupying a special place in the Valley of the Lost. Several years later, Fred's mother cleared out his old room. The floor was in such bad condition that several boards needed replacing. As the old boards were removed, all sorts of things emerged, and there, among the cobwebs and coins and bits of petrified gum, was Reddy, who had somehow fallen into a wide crack and slid out of sight, out of the reach of a boy's small hand. His mother returned Reddy, and Fred placed him on the bookcase in our bedroom where he could see him. Some things are called back from the valley. I believe Reddy called out to Fred. I believe Fred heard. I believe in their mutual jubilance. Some things are not lost but sacrificed. I saw my black coat in the Valley of the Lost, on a random mound, being picked over by desperate urchins. Someone good will get it, I told myself, the Billy Pilgrim of the lot. Do our lost possessions mourn us? Do electric sheep dream of Roy Batty? Will my coat, riddled with holes, remember the rich hours of our companionship, asleep on buses from Vienna to Prague, nights at the opera, walks by the sea, the grave of Swinburne in the Isle of Wight, the arcades of Paris, the caverns of Luray, the cafes of Buenos Aires, human experience bound in its threads, how many poems bleeding from its ragged sleeves. I averted my eyes just for a moment, drawn by another coat that was warmer and softer, but that I did not love. Why is it that we lose the things we love, and things cavalier cling to us and will be the measure of our worth after we're gone? Then it occurred to me, perhaps I absorbed my coat. I suppose I should be grateful, considering its power, that my coat did not absorb me. Then I would seem to be among the missing, though merely tossed over a chair, vibrating, holy. Our lost things, returning to the places from where they came, to their absolute origins, a crucifix to its living tree, or rubies to their home in the Indian Ocean, the genesis of my coat, made from fine wool, spinning backwards through the looms, onto the body of a lamb, a black sheep, a bit apart from the flock grazing on the side of a hill, a lamb opening its eyes to the clouds that resemble for a moment the woolly backs of its own kind. The moon was full and low like a wagon wheel, no doubt flanked by the two identical towers on Lafayette Street, where the head of Picasso's girl with a ponytail dominates a small square. I washed and braided my hair and removed the coffee containers lining my bed, placed the scattered books and pages of notes in neat piles against the wall, removed my Irish linen from a wooden chest, and changed my bedding. I lifted the muslin veil that protects my Brancusi photographs from fading in the sun, a night shot of an endless column in the garden of Steichen, and an immense marble teardrop. I wanted to look at them for a while before I turned out the light. I dreamed I was somewhere that was also nowhere. It looked like a thoroughfare in Raleigh, with small highways crossing each other. No one was around, and then I saw Fred running, though he seldom ran. He didn't like to hurry. At the same moment, something whizzed past him, a wheel on its side, racing as if alive across the highway. And then I saw the object's face, a clock with no hands. I awoke and it was still dark. I lay there for a time, reliving the dream, feeling other dreams stacked behind it. I slowly began to recall the entire body, telescoping backwards, letting my mind stitch the fleeting pieces together. I was high in the mountains. I trustingly followed my guide along a narrow, winding path. I noticed he was slightly bow-legged, and he stopped abruptly. "Look," he said. We were on a high, straight drop. I froze, gripped by an irrational fear of the emptiness before me. He stood with confidence, but I had trouble getting a true footing. I tried to reach for him, but he turned and left. "How can you leave me here?" I cried. "How shall I get back?" I called to him, but he didn't answer. When I tried to move, loose earth and stone broke away. I could not see any way out except for falling or flying. And then the physical terror lifted, and I was on the ground, before a low, whitewashed structure with a blue door. A youth in a billowing white shirt approached me. "How did I get here?" I asked him. "We called to Fred," he said. I saw two men lingering by an old caravan with one wheel missing. "Would you like some tea?" "Yes," I said. He motioned to the others. One of them went inside to prepare it. He heated the water on a brazier and stuffed a pot with mint and brought it to me. "Would you like a saffron cake?" "Yes," I said, suddenly hungry. "We saw you were in danger. We intervened and called to Fred. He swept you up and carried you here." "He is dead," I thought. "How is it possible?" "There is a matter of a fee," said the youth. 100,000 dirhams. "I'm not sure I have that much money, but I will get it." I reached into my pocket, and it was filled with money, exactly what he asked for. But the scene had shifted. I was alone on a stony path surrounded by chalky hills. I paused to reflect on what had happened. Fred had rescued me in a dream. And then suddenly, I was back on the highway, and I saw him in the distance, trailing after the wheel with the face of a clock with no hands.
Get it, Fred, I cried.
And the wheel collided with a massive cornucopia of lost things. It fell on its side, and Fred knelt and placed his hand on it. He flashed a huge smile, one of absolute joy, from a place with no beginning or end.
The hour of noon. My father was born in the shadows of the Bethlehem steel mill as the noon whistle blew. Thus he was born, in accordance with Nietzsche, at the appointed hour when certain individuals are granted the ability to grasp the mystery of the eternal recurrence of all things. My father's mind was beautiful. He seemed to see all philosophies with equal weight and wonder. If one could perceive an entire universe, the possibility of its existence seemed quite tangible, as real as the Riemann hypothesis, as belief itself, unfaltering and divine. We seek to stay present, even as the ghosts attempt to draw us away. Our father manning the loom of eternal return, our mother wandering toward paradise, releasing the thread. In my way of thinking, anything is possible. Life is at the bottom of things and belief at the top, while the creative impulse, dwelling in the center, informs all. We imagine a house, a rectangle of hope, a room with a single bed with a pale coverlet, a few precious books, a stamp album. Walls papered in faded floral fall away and burst as a newborn meadow speckled with sun, and a stream emptying into a greater stream where a small boat awaits with two glowing oars and one blue sail. When my children were young, I contrived such vessels. I set them to sail, though I didn't board them. I rarely left the perimeter of our home. I said my prayers in the night by the canal draped by ancient long-haired willows. The things I touched were living. My husband's fingers, a dandelion, a skinned knee. I didn't seek to frame these moments. They passed without souvenir. But now I cross the sea with the sole aim to possess within a single image the straw hat of Robert Graves, typewriter of Hesse, spectacles of Beckett, the sickbed of Keats. What I have lost and cannot find, I remember. What I cannot see, I attempt to call, working on a string of impulses bordering illumination. I photographed the grave of Rimbaud when I was 26. The pictures were not exceptional, but contained the mission itself, which I had long forgotten. Rimbaud died in a Marseille hospital in 1891 at the age of 37. His last wish was to return to Abyssinia, where he had been a coffee trader. He was dying, and it was not possible for him to be carried aboard ship for the long journey. In his delirium, he imagined himself on horseback in the high Abyssinian plains. I had a string of 19th-century blue glass trade beads from Harar, and I got it in mind to take them to him. In 1973, I went to his gravesite in Charville, near the bank of the Meuse River, and pressed the beads deep into the soil of a large urn that stood before his tombstone, something of his beloved country near to him. I hadn't connected the beads with the stones I'd gathered for Genet, but I suppose they originated from the same romantic impulse. Presumptuous, perhaps, though not erring. I have since returned, and the urn is no longer there. But I believe I am still the same person. No amount of change in the world can change that. I believe in movement. I believe in that light-hearted balloon, the world. I believe in midnight and the hour of noon. But what else do I believe in? Sometimes everything, sometimes nothing. It fluctuates like light flitting over a pond.
I believe in life, which one day each of us shall lose. When we are young, we think we won't, that we are different. As a child, I thought I would never grow up, that I could will it so. And then I realized, quite recently, that I had crossed some line, unconsciously cloaked in the truth of my chronology. How did we get so damn old, I say to my joints, my iron-colored hair. Now I am older than my love, my departed friends. Perhaps I will live so long that the New York Public Library will be obliged to hand over the walking stick of Virginia Woolf. I would cherish it for her and the stones in her pocket, but I would also keep on living, refusing to surrender my pen. I removed my St. Francis towel from around my neck, then braided my hair, still damp, and looked around. Home is a desk, the amalgamation of a dream. Home is the cats, my books, and my work never done. All the lost things that may one day call to me. The faces of my children who will one day call to me. Maybe we can't draw flesh from reverie, nor retrieve a dusty spur, but we can gather the dream itself and bring it back uniquely whole. I called to Cairo and she hopped onto the bed. I looked up and saw a singular star rise above my skylight. I tried to rise as well, but all at once gravity had the better of me, and I was swept by the edges of a strange music. I saw the fist of a babe shaking a silver rattle. I saw the shadow of a man in the brim of his Stetson hat. He was toying with a kid's lariat, and then he knelt down, untied the knot, and laid it on the ground. "Watch," he said. The snake ate its tail, let go, and ate again. The lariat was a long string of slithering words. I leaned over to read what they said. My oracle. I checked my pocket, but I had neither pen nor script. "Some things," the cowpoke breathed, "we save for ourselves." It was the hour of showdown, the miraculous hour. I shielded my eyes from the punishing light, dusted off my jacket, and threw it over my shoulder. I knew exactly where I was. I fell out of the frame and saw what I was seeing. Same lone cafe, different dream. The dun-colored exterior had been repainted a bright canary yellow, and the rusted gas pump was covered with what appeared to be a massive tea cozy. I just shrugged and sashayed in, but the place was unrecognizable. The tables and chairs and the jukebox were gone. The knotty pine panels had been stripped away, and the faded walls were painted colonial blue with white wainscoting. There were crates of technical equipment, metal office furniture, and stacks of brochures. I leafed through a pile, Hawaii, Tahiti, and the Taj Mahal Casino in Atlantic City, a travel agency in the middle of nowhere. I went into the back room, but the coffee maker, beans, wooden spoons, and earthenware mugs were all gone. Even the empty mezcal bottles were gone. There were no ashtrays and no sign of my philosophic cowpoke. I sensed he had been heading this way and most likely, spotting the spanking new paint job, just kept on going. I looked around. Nothing to hold me here either, not even the dried carcass of a dead bee. I figured if I hustled, I might spot the clouds of dust left behind where his old Ford flatbed passed. Maybe I could catch up with him and hitch myself a ride. We could travel the desert together, no agent required. "I love you," I whispered, "to all, to none. Love not lightly," I heard him say. And then I walked out, straight through the twilight, treading the beaten earth. There were no dust clouds, no signs of anyone, but I paid no mind. I was my own lucky hand of solitaire, the desert landscape unchanging, a long, unwinding scroll that I would one day amuse myself by filling. I'm going to remember everything, and then I'm going to write it all down. An aria to a coat, a requiem for a cafe. That's what I was thinking, in my dream, looking down at my hands. This is Patti Smith. I hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of M-Train. This program was produced by Tony Shanahan, recorded by James Frazee at Electric Lady Studios and Hobo Sound. Executive producer, Orly Moskowitz. Text copyright 2015 by Patti Smith. Production copyright 2015, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.